This is the second episode out of three about the impact of type 2 inflammation in patients who suffer from severe asthma, chronic rhinosinusitis, or atopic dermatitis. Today, we'll discuss treatment options in difficult-to-treat chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps, and therefore, we have Professor Witske Fokkens from the Academic Medical Center in the Netherlands to join us. Friday the 12th of November, she gave a lecture about chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps, which you can listen to now.
I'm Witske Fokkens. I'm a professor of rhinology in the Amsterdam UMC in the Academic Medical Center. And what I would like to discuss with you today is something about chronic rhinosinusitis with and without nasal polyps and the correlation with the lower airways. We will talk about the new EPOS classification, the integrated care pathways there, and then a lot about treatment of these recalcitrant patients. I hope you're all aware of this EPOS clinical definition of chronic rhinosinusitis. It's important to realize that there has to be inflammation with symptoms of nasal blockage and rhinorrhea. If that's not the case, it's not chronic rhinosinusitis. So a patient with only facial pain, for example, does not have chronic rhinosinusitis. And then we have some extra signs like facial pain, and especially in patients with nasal polyps, loss of smell. And we want to see signs of disease either by endoscopy, of course, the ideal way to show disease for ENT surgeons, but it can also be done by CT scan, where we want to see mucosal changes within the sinuses and the osteomyelitis complex.
We know from data that the prevalence of developing chronic rhinosinusitis is different from country to country. What about the chronic rhinosinusitis and asthma? What is the association?
If we look at associations between chronic rhinosinusitis and asthma and allergic rhinitis, you see that there is an association with allergic rhinitis, with current asthma, with smoking, and these associations between chronic rhinosinusitis and either allergic rhinitis and current asthma remain after correction for smoking and are found in all age groups, men and women. Chronic rhinosinusitis is mostly correlated with late onset asthma.
Professor Fokkens is now showing a graph over different types of diseases and how much they impact the quality of life.
This is already an older study, 15 years old, but still very important. Looking at the SF-36, so a general quality of life questionnaire, the red top is great quality of life, bottom is very bad quality of life. The red line for chronic rhinosinusitis, almost overlapping COPD, definitely worse than migraine, for example, or heart disease or head and neck cancer. So significant impact on quality of life of patients. We all realize that our former classification of chronic rhinosinusitis in either having polyps or not having polyps is, of course, an enormous simplification of the truth. And we now more and more start to realize, just like in asthma, the importance of endotyping. We understand that the endotype is the basis of the disease, that barrier dysfunction has an important role in the pathophysiology of the disease, and that there is a genetic, so both the host and the environment seem to play an important role. And the same things that happen that are important in asthma seem to be very important in chronic rhinosinusitis, eventually leading to remodeling and the phenotype that we see in our daily practice.
In 2020, a new positioning paper came from EPOS. What is new?
We try to make a new classification of chronic rhinosinusitis where we try to divide the disease into primary chronic rhinosinusitis versus secondary chronic rhinosinusitis. And secondary, you have to think of all sorts of diseases that lead to chronic rhinosinusitis but are not primary found there, like cystic fibrosis, PCD, GPA, Wegener's disease, Church-Strauss, EGPA, immunodeficiencies, etc. For now, we're mostly interested in the primary CRS, and I want to focus on the diffuse bilateral primary CRS, being either type 2, leading to polyps, but also allergic fungal rhinosinusitis or eosinophilic chronic rhinosinusitis or CCAD, or non-eosinophilic chronic rhinosinusitis. Again, primary chronic rhinosinusitis first categorized into localized disease or diffuse disease, and then categorized in the endotype dominant. Within EPOS 2020, we propose care pathways for chronic rhinosinusitis. Today, we are interested in secondary, tertiary care, difficult to treat disease, and especially the diffuse bilateral chronic rhinosinusitis. What are we doing? Well, in primary care, first, appropriate medical treatment is used, so nasal steroid drops, or spray, rinses, saline rinses, talk about compliance with our patients, and consider oral corticosteroids. If the patient is sent to the ENT surgeon, we now try to emphasize the importance of first steps of endotyping. And you see that here, divide into, do an additional workup, divide into non-type 2 and type 2 disease. You can quite easily in daily practice in your clinic think about endotyping and what is the relevant type. Because the patient with type 2 usually complain about loss of smell, about blockage, about aspirin intolerance, NSID exacerbated respiratory disease. They have asthma, very often late onset asthma, and can have atopy. If you look in the nose, you see polyps or eosinophilic mucin. And we really like ENT surgeon. That's something we have to start to really do every day, measure in the blood whether the patient have elevated IgE. It's not about specific IgE. It's about total IgE and blood eosinophils. If we look at a typical non-type 2 patient, the main complaint is often discharge or facial pain. There is less asthma. There is less atopy. In the nose, we see purulence, not polyps, and the lab is usually normal with normal IgE and no eosinophilia. And this categorization in type 2 and non-type 2 has consequences for the treatment. Not particularly in the first time, because we give appropriate medical treatment, as I said before, and if that's insufficient, we very often do sinus surgery. But already here we see in the type 2 that we incline to use systemic corticosteroids. In the non-type 2, we can consider long-term antibiotics. However, if the patient is recalcitrant to this treatment, if it's difficult to treat, then the large differences occur. In patients with type 2 disease, we can consider now to use a biological, I'll come to that later, aspirin treatment after desensitization. We can taper with oral corticosteroids, although I've done that a lot in the past, but now we will, when it's possible in your country, and I'm very happy to understand that it is or will be very soon possible in Denmark, we will go in those patients to a biological, which is a lot less harmful. And we, of course, can do revision therapy. In non-type 2 disease, there are other options like rinsing with xylitol, long-term antibiotics. And we have to consider whether this is actually primary CRS or that there is an underlying disease like a vasculitis or an immune disorder.
Is there a correlation between CRS with NP and asthma?
A number of meta-analysis done on this subject. And you see, if we look at patients after functional endoscopic sinus surgery, all patients having asthma, in three quarters of the patients, the asthma becomes better. for the amount of oral corticosteroid use, the decreased inhaled corticosteroids, and the decreased bronchoinhaler in a later use. So in general, we can say that the treatment of the upper airways in patients with chronic rhinosinusitis is important for the lower airways. And already 15 years ago, Valerie Lund and Rahab showed that it doesn't really matter whether you do it medically or surgically here in this study. But you see that there was no difference between a surgical and a medical treated group. In the last few years, and these data are not perfect because they're all based on cohort analysis and not randomized controlled trials, but in different cohorts, we have seen that patients that are operated relatively early in their disease do significantly better than patients that are operated later in the disease. An early cohort operated in the first year, and a late cohort operated 5 years after they were first diagnosed with chronic rhinosinusitis. And you see in the beginning after surgery, they do almost equally well. But over a five-year period, the patients who are operated earlier do significantly better than the patients that are operated late. And the same is true for the number of healthcare visits and the number of prescriptions. Patients that were operated early did significantly better than the patients that were operated late. This was two studies from the UK, another study from the US, which shows exactly the same data. Patients that are operated early here, it was in the first 2 years after diagnosis, did significantly better than the patients that were operated later. So, in the last minutes, I told you that the prevalence of chronic rhinosinusitis is around 11%. The prevalence of chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps is significantly lower, around 2%. That there is a correlation with mainly late onset asthma, that you have to realize how much quality of life of patients with chronic rhinosinusitis is impaired. I showed you the new EPOS classification, and I showed you the integrated pathways in chronic rhinosinusitis, and that early treatment of chronic rhinosinusitis seems to better improve lower airway disease than later treatment.
What a great lecture in the understanding of CRS with NP. I've heard ENT specialists talk about a paradigm shift in how to treat these patients. Is this true?
Well, let's look now what that treatment can be. A summary from an earlier EPOS version, EPOS 2012, summarized the way we treated rhinosinusitis, had medical treatment, surgery plus medical treatment, and then we decided, is the patient well controlled? Well, great, medical treatment partially controlled. We tried to step up medical treatment, give periods of short courses of systemic steroids or antibiotics, and if that was still insufficient, we did revision surgery, and then the whole circle went around. So in tertiary care, where we of course see a lot of uncontrolled patients, this went on, this circle of revision surgery, stepping up revision surgery, went on and on. And these patients, over the years, collected a lot of steroid dose, systemic steroid dose, as you already saw in the former slide, and especially the patient with polyps have significant number of short-term courses of systemic steroids and sometimes even tapering doses of steroids to keep them from having surgery every year. We all know that systemic steroid adds, and not only In the long-term use, of course, in the long-term use, we all realize the risk of osteoporosis, of more infections, of diabetes and hypertension. But also many patients complain about the short-term use, the mood changes, the sleep disturbances, the hypertension, the gain weight, etc. So within the guidelines in the last years, APOL says, take measures to minimize adverse events. Make a CT scan once in a while to check on osteoporosis, for example. Measure diabetes, etc. Measure tension. ICAR said risk of long-term frequent systemic corticosteroid use outweighs benefits to patients. The Euphoria expert opinion said adverse events associated with repeated systemic steroid use is a major concern. And the EAACI position paper said that the adverse events outweigh advantages of benefits in the long term, except in patients with very severe symptomatology. And well, that's exactly the patients we're going to talk about now. What are we going to do with these very severe patients? And that is now the new paradigm, the new kit, the fantastic change that we have had the last 2 years, and that's the possibility to use biologics. In the Netherlands, until December 2019, I could only prescribe a biologic when my pulmonologist was so kind to do that, and could only do it if the patient had severe asthma. So a patient with only severe polyps and moderate asthma was dependent on oral corticosteroids with all the side effects we had. But now we can prescribe ourselves.
Which biologic for whom with severe asthma?
At this moment in Western Europe, there are three biologicals on the market for chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps. Anti-IL-5, and at the on the market is mepolizumab at the moment, resluzumab, not for polyps, only for asthma. Anti-IL-4 receptor alpha, dupilumab, and anti-IgE, omalizumab. And I will go into these different biologics in the next minutes. Dupilumab, two studies, one for 24 weeks, one for 52 weeks. They have exactly the similar design, but in the 24 weeks, treatment was stopped after 24 weeks. In the second part of the graph, symptoms here, total, the SNOT 22, total score, slowly coming back. And in the 52 weeks, halfway at 24 weeks, patients were switched from once every 2 weeks to once every 4 weeks. And very interestingly, if you switch to once every 4 weeks after a good reduction of symptoms, the symptoms remain very low, almost or totally the same over that second half year. The same was seen for omalizumab, exactly the same sort of data. And a little bit less impressive, but also that was a different sort of design for mepolizumab. Not only symptoms, the same cartoons for nasal polyp score, for Dupi, for omalizumab, and very important, the UPSET score with significant improvement of smell. And patients are so happy when their smell is so much better after many years. The same for omalizumab, a little bit less for MAPO. Of course, there's a long experience in the lower airways and in skin is a very safe medication. The data we have until now for dupilumab also shows no significant side effects. Sometimes we have a little problems with having the eosinophils under control in the beginning of the treatment. There are two big choices to make in the coming year, and that is which patient do I give a biological and which biological do I give to which patient? And EPOS proposed a number of criteria to choose the patients that will most benefit from a biological treatment. We propose to give it only to patients who had sinus surgery, because the patients who do well on sinus surgery do not need it. Evidence of type 2 inflammation, of course, need for systemic steroids, significant impaired quality of life, significant loss of smell, and diagnosis of comorbid asthma. So to summarize the last part of my presentation, in corticosteroid treatment, I think most people agree that in almost all patients, the adverse events of the treatment outweigh the advantages, especially in the long term. For those patients that need often systemic steroids, who have uncontrolled disease, who are recalcitrant to our other treatment, there is now a real paradigm shift with biologics in the treatment of these patients. And finally, I would like to advertise the EPOS position paper on rhinosinusitis. And you can, as I told you, download this for free, either from the Rhinology website or from the EPOS 2020 website. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much for an inspiring talk about treatment options in difficult-to-treat chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyps. If you are interested in watching the session with all the slides and references, you can find a recorded session at the website sanofimed.dk. Here you will also find a panel discussion where more cases are discussed. In the next episode, we'll look into type 2 inflammation and atopic dermatitis. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening. Stay safe.